All right. Thanks so much. My name is Neil. I'm a compulsive overeater. Terry asked me if I would be willing to qualify at this meeting, and I was told early on that the most important things that I can do in OA is to not take the first compulsive bite and always say yes when given an opportunity to do service. And it's really through service that I have been, you know, continually reinforced as being capable, you know, that I have the ability by sharing my story to possibly influence somebody in this fellowship for the better. And, you know, I'm in another fellowship, and kind of owning the space that you exist in is difficult. And, you know, we just turned one meeting from a phone meeting into a Zoom meeting, and there's so many people who don't want to activate their video feed. And I remember when I, you know, when I first came into OA, it was in 1990. I had been in AA for 7 years, and about 15 months into my sobriety, I did my first, fourth, and fifth step, and I met a woman who was going through her second divorce with an alcoholic husband. And you know, we ended up getting together, and we've been married for 36 years. But about 6 months after we started dating, she came into OA and AA, and it was 5 years later before I became willing to look at my relationship with food as being unnatural or somewhat abnormal, and came in. And I have to say that I think the general, you know, the difference between the two programs was that OA was, you know, the membership was largely female, whereas in AA it was, you know, 50-50, or back in 1983, there were probably more men. But there was a kindness and a patience that I experienced in OA that enabled me to begin to stop blaming external things for the situations that I found myself in, and kind of got that out of my system. And so I kind of alienated people in the first year, and then spent the next 25 years sort of, you know, proving that I had been listening, and you know, I was getting better. But as far as my story, a couple of things happened early in my life that I think set the stage for me to become a relief-seeking kind of person. One was that I was born in September of 1953. And a week after I was born, my mother contracted polio. And, you know, needless to say, I'm sure she had a lot of physical therapy and a lot of things that she had to do. And so, you know, as a newborn, I'm sure she wasn't around as much as, you know, the typical mother might be. And the second one is that I had some serious gastrointestinal problems, you know, a lot of vomiting and diarrhea. And, you know, I mean, that's just physically being out of control. And I was just physically in a lot of pain, a lot of food sensitivities. And I mean, ironically, they thought I had celiac, so they weren't giving me sugar and they weren't giving me flour products. And I think that's ironic, because I kind of ended up, you know, that became kind of the backbone of my food plan, to refrain from those things because they triggered cravings. And so, you know, that experience of not having my mother around as much as I might otherwise have had, and the physical discomfort, the chronic physical discomfort, I think translated into me feeling out of control, you know, just being in chronic pain, which I think ultimately translated in my head into, you wouldn't be in chronic pain unless there was something wrong with you. Like there was something deep inside of me that was bad or wrong. And I was a very emotional kid and a very anxious kid. I was later diagnosed as having ADD. And, you know, that impulsivity and you know, saying the first thing came into my mind, you know, those were things that became problematic. And, you know, I just felt in some ways that the world owed me a living, you know, that if you felt the way I felt, then you'd be able to do whatever you wanted to. And that those became kind of refrains that, commonly came up. So I really, you know, at the age of two, sugar was introduced into my diet and I really took to it and I ate it to excess. And then, you know, there were other things that you know, clearly demonstrated that I did not have a particularly balanced attitude towards food. My mother used to play mahjong with her friends. I'm Jewish. I grew up in upper middle class Jewish family in New York, in Queens. And you know, if that wasn't enough to put a chip on my shoulder and make me feel like I was better than everybody else, then, anyhow, I'm not going to go there. But she used to have this this kind of crystal bowl, and she used to have quarters in there. I guess they used to, you know, play for little money, you know, but they used to play. And I used to pilfer quarters out of this crystal bowl. So I was early on led to a life of crime, and I would pilfer quarters from the bowl. I would walk down the corner to Al's candy store. I'd meet Larry Weiss there. And then we would just binge out on sugar like crazy. And, you know, I just developed weird. I mean, I used to take a skewer and I'd put, you know, like when you have a camp out and you put those things on the stick and you put them over the fire, not the hot dogs, the white little square ones. And I would take like six of those at a time and I'd put them over the burner on the stove. And then I would do this fire eating after. I would like push them down and I would eat like 25 marshmallows, you know, and that I don't think is typical behavior. And so I was constantly doing things like that where I would, eat, in my elementary school, which was just down the block from my house, right before we break for lunch, I was able to go home for lunch. They would have, you know, some cookie or pretzel or something like that. And you could, you know, for a penny or a nickel or whatever it was, you could buy them. And I was, you know, constantly have like a half a dozen or a dozen of those before I went home and had lunch. I was extremely active. You know, I think the ADD thing might have been an ADH thing when I was younger. And I constantly ran around and I played, you know, and so I was thin, really thin. And so, you know, I adopted the habit of camping in front of the TV with a bag or a box or something. And I think my mother was kind of happy that I was eating, you know, because I was so skinny. But that was another thing, that combination of fantasy and ritualized eating. I logged in a lot of hours on the TV. You know, I was a child of the 60s and, you know, TV shows, and I just binged on TV. But it was, you know, it was like a form of fantasy. And that was another release for me, you know, whether it was just staring out the window and daydreaming and not paying attention at school or whatever it was. I constantly did not want to be present in my body. And with the accompaniment of food, what that really did was it stunted my ability to tolerate uncomfortable feelings and to, you know, be solutions oriented and action oriented the way I am now in program. You know, today, if something troubles me, I try to get to the bottom of it. Stream of consciousness writing, a journal, I'll use the tools, you know. Tools are there, you know, you use a tool to build something or to, you know, make something better. I got sober and abstinent in Boston, in the greater Boston area, and the, you know, Mass Bay intergroup meetings, which were called the 90-day meetings. And 90 day was an approach that started about 40 years ago. And, in a place where there was not a lot of long-term physical recovery, continuous abstinence type, they began to, they used to use group step studies, and they adopted the thing that if you broke your abstinence, you had to leave the step study group. And people began to stay abstinent a day at a time, you know, consistently, continuously. And so in the meetings, they said that, you know, we suggest that you have 90 days of abstinence before you could share at the meeting. And, you know, it might have seemed unfair or like there was a, you know, kind of a second class citizen status accorded to people who weren't continuously abstinent. But But they said, you know, no, this is like intensive care. You know, the meetings are here for the people who are having trouble getting abstinent. And you sit in the front row and you listen and we're speaking to you. You know, and then it became like The Price is Right. I could see that people who stayed abstinent for 90 days in a row were so excited. Oh, we used to have to go to the front of the room. That's why I said Price is Right, because it's like, come on down. You used to have to go to the front of the room and say, I'm so-and-so and I'm a compulsive eater, and stand there. And, you know, that was something that I think there's a lot of us that have a fear of public speaking. And, you know, we don't necessarily like that. And, you know, the interesting thing was, is where it was, you know, I was very self-conscious in the beginning. You know, after the third or fourth time, you know, that fear just went out of my head. And it was a very good way of teaching me that I could do something that I might strenuously object to, and then in a very short time, adapt to it and come to embrace it, and really just overcome knee-jerk reactions to things, resistance to trying things. I was not good at asking for help. And in 90-day OA, you know, you were said, you know, you make go to three meetings a week and make three phone calls a day, and the meetings are committed meetings. And if, you know, there's a playoff game or some other thing going on, you go to your meeting, right? And if you miss a meeting, you have to make up a meeting, and you're not late for a meeting, and, you know, and then you take a service position at the meeting, and you participate, you know, that this is a audience participation kind of thing. Even if you're not talking, you participate by doing the courtesy of listening to the person who's speaking. And, you know, that taught me that I live in a world with other people, many of whom are not like me, and that we all have something to offer. You know, so Seema, these are some of the things that I learned. So I began writing down my food, and I did a food inventory, and I saw what my trigger foods were, and I weighed and measured three meals a day, and I didn't have flour and sugar. In my case, I didn't have artificial sweeteners. And that actually came as a result of being in one of the step studies, where one of the rules was you don't have artificial sweeteners. And I said, well, you know, I really only have like maybe a Diet Coke a day. I mean, so, you know, and she said, so great, it won't be a big problem for you to give it up, which really pissed me off. And yet after, you know, a year and a half after not having had it, and I realized, hey, I could have that if I want. I said, why would I want, you know, like I'm doing fine without it. And that's really been the story of my plan of eating, which has been an evolutionary process. When I first came into OA, I was dealing with a small peptic ulcer. And so having caffeinated coffee was really a bad idea. And I realized one of the things that I did, one of the compulsive food behaviors is I would have foods that had a laxative effect. And, you know, I kind of was attracted to that. I thought, oh, I'll lose weight, you know, if I have to run to the bathroom 10 minutes after I eat this or drink that, you know? So, and one of the good things about putting very firm boundaries around my food plan is I've been abstinent since January of 1996. So it's 27 years. I still think pizza and coffee are the two greatest smells that God ever put on this earth. And I don't eat either of them, but there's something inside of me that still feels like if I could get away with it, I really, you know, wouldn't it be great if? And that just shows me that no matter how long I'm abstinent, I still have a mechanism inside my brain, a persistent false message that eating things that aren't good for me is a good idea. And that's why weighing and measuring and putting boundaries, healthy limits that teach me that the center of the spiritual bullseye in my OA recovery is enough, not too much, not too little. Don't eat too much and then concentrate on how much exercise you can do to, you know, normalize my weight, which is one of the things that I used to do. I used athletics. But another reason I used athletics is because I was, you know, pretty gifted athletically, and where I felt because of the ADD out of place in school and you know, could just kind of emotionally repressed and not confident necessarily, you know, speaking intimately about my feelings, I could dominate in an athletic arena. And I was like one of the earliest trash talkers that there was. I didn't want to just beat my opponent. I wanted to physically dominate them and tell them I was going to beat them and how, and then smile when it pissed them off. And again, you know, at the age of 35, I stopped really playing competitive sports because I was still ready to like get in a fist fight over a loose ball or something. You know, I mean, it didn't bring out the best in me, you know. Today, I'm a different kind
of reminder.
Thank you. So, you know, so I, you know, my story and program is I work a rigorous program. I do a lot of service at the group level, at the intergroup level. I sponsor, you know, and where I used to be kind of a drill sergeant who used to like, you know, keeping my recruits in line. I share up to the level of my own experience, and I encourage people to continually broaden their recovery network. In my other program, we have action partners, basically accountability partners. And I integrated that into my program with sponsees because I think sometimes people will put a sponsee up on a different level, and it's really not anything that I support. I'll share my difficulties with my sponsees. It's not like, oh, I'm not supposed to tell you that. I'm supposed to like be, you know, rock solid. But to me, it's like facing adversity or maybe even a doubt or a lack of faith and not picking up the first compulsive bite and working my program and like reinvesting in my program. That's what OA has taught me to do. You know, hold fast, don't eat, even if your ass is on fire, and then do the next right thing, you know, and pray. And, you know, some of the breakthroughs that have happened to me in recent years, I'll be 70 in September. And I know you all want to say you don't look like you're 70, but I'm at the age where if someone says that, you think they're just, you know, brown nosing, and it may or may not really be true. Either that or I'm just still mentally ill and I can't tell the difference. But I, you know, I just have complete faith that I there's a loving God in my life who wants the best for me. And sometimes he shows me the best by not giving me what I think I want and showing me why having to continually refine my character, it will let me know when getting something that I want is God's will and not just a distortion of my own will. And so my faith is as deep as it's ever been. And I've been given some economic circumstances that have been very challenging. And I believe that God's in charge. God's my employer. Whatever money I have, he's lending to me to use in whatever way. And learning to do without has been, you know, I did it with food. And I learned, you know, being hungry is not an existential crisis. In fact, the first meetings I went to were from 4:15 to 5:15. And I would come in with a head of steam. And then I'd be close enough to dinner that I would like totally crash out and almost like go to sleep. And then I would wake up and then be inspired by what was happening at the meeting. And then it would be like, wow, I feel great. And even better, it's 5:15. I get to go home and have dinner. And it was the first time in my life I learned you could get hungry and 10 minutes later, it would go away. You know, so today when I look at my watch ready for lunch and it's 9:30 in the morning, you know, I'll have a cup of tea or I'll just do the next right thing. And if I'm resistant to doing the next right thing, I just say, you only have to do it for 15 minutes. And, you know, I distract my disease. I tell it, you know, it's not in charge, you know, that it's kind of like a young child, that it's not really the right person to make adult decisions and it should have a timeout until, you know, I'm ready for it. And so I'm constantly reinforcing how to be self-supporting emotionally and mentally and spiritually. And when those three things line up, my thoughts and my actions and my feelings, and, you know, there's a consistent line running through them, but I know that I'm doing God's will and I'm a much better person for it. So, you know, being in OA has been the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm married to the same lady for 36 years. She's in program. I'm better sibling and step parent. And, you know, I'm actually estranged from my grandkids right now. And that's like the saddest thing in my life. And I constantly want to intervene and or get mad. And you know what? I just need to be patient.
Make a reminder.
Okay. So, you know, so I'm, you know, when Terry asked me to do service, it was like 5:00. I'm like, all right. But, you know, my job was to be up and conscious. So I got up 45 minutes early, did a little stretching, and here I am. And you know, my day is going to start out well. And, you know, I've got an 11 o'clock appointment with my sponsor. We're going through the steps again. And I'm, you know, I've been doing some writing and, you know, and then tonight I lead a step study group, you know, and we're going into step six. And so it's a recovery. It's a self-care day, you know, and that's a good day. And just like an abstinent day, you know, I have as much respect for the power of one day of abstinence now as I ever did when I first came in and was totally.